The difference between modernization and westernization, particularly but not exclusively in relation to men and women, can be vividly seen in the dress reforms that began at the end of the 18th century and have continued, with occasional interruptions, ever since. The process began when the Sultan formed new style regiments in Western formations with Western weapons, commanded by Western style officers, graded in Western style ranks. It was natural that the Sultan should also dress his new army in Western-style uniforms. Indeed, one of the early documents urging reform explicitly mentions uniforms and their military, especially disciplinary usefulness, for example, in making it easy to recognize and arrest deserters. From the military, the clothing reform spread to the civil service, and bureaucrats were now attired in frock coats and trousers, in place of their previous, more comfortable clothing. Only the headgear, the fez, the turban, the kefir remained, to symbolize their difference from the West. Anyone who has visited an Ottoman cemetery will recall the headstones, topped with a carved representation of the distinctive headgear of the person buried there, thus identifying the grave of a Janissary officer, a Qadi, or other. Headgear remained particularly important in a symbolic, even a religious sense. But even that has now changed. For a long time, Middle Eastern soldiers wore European uniforms with Muslim headgear, eschewing Western-style hats and caps with brims and peaks that obstructed Muslim worship and were thus seen as the symbol of the infidel. In those days, sapka giymek, to put on a hat, was the Turkish equivalent of to turn one's coat, i.e. to become a renegade. Now that, too, has gone. Today, the armed forces, the civil service, and a large part of the urban male population have adopted Western styles of clothing. Even the diplomats of the Islamic Republic of Iran wear Western suits, with only the missing necktie to symbolize their rejection of Western culture and its symbols. For some reason, they have given the necktie a symbolic significance, perhaps because of its vaguely cruciform shape. While the dividing line between westernization and modernization is sometimes difficult to establish in the attire of men, it is very clear in that of women. Unlike soldiers and civil servants, in the past both exclusively male occupations, women were never compelled to adopt Western dress or to abandon traditional attire. Indeed, if the matter arose at all in public regulations, it was in the form of a prohibition, not a requirement. Nevertheless, some women did adopt at least elements of Western dress, and in our own day some items of clothing, notably the headscarf and the veil, have become powerful emotive symbols of cultural choice. They are especially so in Turkey and Iran, the two countries that most clearly formulate the alternative choices and alternative futures that confront the Muslim, and not only the Muslim, Middle East. For men to wear Western clothes, it would seem, is modernization. For women to wear them is westernization, to be welcomed or punished accordingly. The Middle Eastern response to Western science shows interesting similarities with the response to feminism. It also shows striking differences. At first, the one, like the other, was negative, even contemptuous, and Hati Effendi's comments were not untypical. But the benefits of scientific education, unlike those of female emancipation, were palpable, visible and immediate, first in military matters, which were the prime concern of the reformers, and then also in other aspects of life. To teach gunnery and seamanship, it was necessary to impart some knowledge of the sciences on which these were based. With the growth and spread of modern military and naval instruction, both teachers and pupils achieved insights and vision beyond those that navigation could afford, with results more penetrating and more explosive than gunfire. Through the 19th century, an increasing number of young Muslims, most of them officers or civil servants, most of them Ottoman, began to speak of how Europe, the smallest of the continents, achieved paramountcy in the modern world through its mastery of the sciences. Some speak more broadly of knowledge. The same word designates both knowledge and science. In an essay published in 1840, Mustafa Sami, a former chief secretary of the Ottoman embassy in Paris, goes a step further and notes with astonishment, "Every European, man and woman, can read and write. All of them, men and women alike, get at least 10 years of schooling. There are special schools where even the deaf and dumb are taught to read and write. Thanks to their science, Europeans have found ways of overcoming plague and other illnesses, and have invented many mechanical devices to mass-produce various items. Another Ottoman with diplomatic experience, Sadiq Rifat Pasha, speaks of the importance that Europeans attach to astronomy, music, medicine, and international politics and military knowledge, plants, animals, minerals, and anatomy. He also notes that in Europe, one cannot meet anybody who is unable to read and write in his own language. This was probably an exaggeration in mid-19th century Europe, but a minor one compared with the difference between the conditions he described and the conditions at home. During the second half of the 19th century, Ottoman intellectuals placed ever greater emphasis on the importance of science. Some of them went further and spoke of a conflict between science and what they cautiously called fanaticism, or even, explicitly, between science and religion. Increasing numbers of European scientific books were translated, often with prefaces, insisting on the importance of science for progress. Materialism and later positivism also found translators and disciples. One popular author was the Anglo-American scientist and philosopher John William Draper, 1811 to 1882, whose History of the Conflict Between Religion and Science, published in 1872 in the United States, was published in Istanbul in Turkish translation in 1895. Another much-admired European materialist was Friedrich Carl Christian Ludwig Büchner, 1824 to 1899. He, and more especially Auguste Comte, greatly influenced the political thinking of the Young Turks and their imitators among other Muslim peoples. And yet, despite all these efforts, and despite the foundation of schools and faculties of sciences in almost all the new universities, the incorporation of modern science, or should one say Western science, was lamentably slow. The reluctance of the Islamic Middle East to accept European science is the more remarkable if one considers the immense contribution of the Islamic civilization of the Middle Ages to the rise of modern science. In the development and transmission of the various branches of science, men in the medieval Middle East, some Christian, some Jewish, most of them Muslim, played a vital role. They had inherited the ancient wisdom of Egypt and Babylon. They had translated and preserved much that would have otherwise been lost of the wisdom and science of Persia and Greece. Their enterprise and their openness enabled them to add much that was new from the science and techniques of India and China. Nor was the role of the medieval Islamic scientist purely one of collection and preservation. In the medieval Middle East, scientists developed an approach rarely used by the ancients: experiment. Through this and other means, they brought major advances in virtually all the sciences. Much of this was transmitted to the medieval West, whence eager students went to study in what were then Muslim centers of learning in Spain and Sicily, while others translated scientific texts from Arabic into Latin, some original, some adapted from ancient Greek works. Modern science owes an immense debt to these transmitters. And then, approximately from the end of the Middle Ages, there was a dramatic change. In Europe, the scientific movement advanced enormously in the era of the Renaissance, the discoveries, the technological revolution, and the vast changes, both intellectual and material, that preceded, accompanied, and followed them. In the Muslim world, independent inquiry virtually came to an end, and science was, for the most part, reduced to the veneration of a corpus of approved knowledge. There were some practical innovations. Thus, for example, incubators were invented in Egypt, vaccination against smallpox in Turkey. These were, however, not seen as belonging to the realm of science, but as practical devices, and we know of them primarily from Western travelers. The changing attitudes of East and West in the development and acceptance of scientific knowledge are dramatically exemplified in the discovery of the circulation of the blood. In Western histories of science, this is normally credited to the English physician William Harvey, whose epoch-making Essay on the Motion of the Heart and Blood was published in 1628 and transformed both the theory and practice of medicine. His great discovery was preceded and helped by the work of a Spanish physician and theologian, Miguel Serveto, usually known as Michael Servetus, 1511 to 1553, who owes his place in scientific history to the discovery, published in 1553, of the lesser or pulmonary circulation of the blood. This discovery was anticipated in surprisingly similar detail by a 13th century Syrian physician called Ibn al-Nafis. Among his writings was a medical treatise in which, in defiance of the revered authority of Galen and Avicenna, he set forth his theory of the circulation of the blood in terms very similar to those later used by Servetus and adopted by Harvey, but unlike theirs, based on abstract reasoning rather than experiment. Modern Orientalist scholarship has shown, with a high degree of probability, that Servetus knew of the work of Ibn al-Nafis, thanks to a Renaissance scholar called Andrea Alpago, died circa 1520, who spent many years in Syria collecting and translating Arabic medical manuscripts. Ibn al-Nafis was a successful and wealthy physician who died at the age of about 80. A childless widower, he left his luxurious house, his estate, and his library to a Cairo hospital. His book and his theory remained unknown and had no effect on the practice of medicine. Servetus was arrested in Geneva on August 14, 1553, and charged with blasphemy and heresy. The Protestant authorities, and notably Calvin, demanded that he retract his religious opinions or face the consequences. Servetus refused. He was condemned on October 26, 1553, and burned next day as a heretic. His medical work remained and formed the basis of major scientific advances in the years that followed. Another example of the widening gap may be seen in the fate of the great observatory built in Galata in Istanbul in 1577. This was due to the initiative of Taqi al-Din, circa 1526 to 1585, a major figure in Muslim scientific history and the author of several books on astronomy, optics, and mechanical clocks. Born in Syria or Egypt, the sources differ, he studied in Cairo, and after a career as jurist and theologian, he went to Istanbul, where in 1571 he was appointed Muneccim Bashi, astronomer and astrologer-in-chief to the Sultan Selim II. A few years later, he persuaded the new Sultan, Murad III, to allow him to build an observatory, comparable in its technical equipment and its specialist personnel with that of his celebrated contemporary, the Danish astronomer Tycho Brahe. But there the comparison ends. Tycho Brahe's observatory, and the work accomplished in it, opened the way to a vast new development of astronomical science. Taqi al-Din's observatory was razed to the ground by a squad of Janissaries, by order of the Sultan, on the recommendation of the Chief Mufti. This observatory had many predecessors in the lands of Islam. It had no successors until the age of modernization. The relationship between Christendom and Islam in the sciences was now reversed. Those who had been disciples now became teachers. Those who had been masters became pupils, often reluctant and resentful pupils. They were willing enough to accept the products of infidel science in warfare and medicine, where they could make the difference between victory and defeat, between life and death. But the underlying philosophy and the socio-political context of these scientific achievements proved more difficult to accept or even to recognize. This rejection is one of the more striking differences between the Middle East and other parts of the non-Western world that have, in one way or another, endured the impact of Western civilization. At the present time, scientists in many Asian countries make important contributions to what is no longer a Western but a worldwide scientific movement. Except for some Westernized enclaves in the Middle East, and some scientists of Middle Eastern origin working in the West, the Middle Eastern contribution, as reflected, for example, in the internationally recognized journals that are at the cutting edge of scientific progress, compares poorly with that of other non-Western regions, or even more dramatically, with its own past record. the response to Western music, and the larger question of cultural change that it raises, deserve fuller treatment. Chapter 4. Modernization and Social Equality. It is often said that Islam is an egalitarian religion. There is much truth in this assertion. If we compare Islam at the time of its advent with the societies that surrounded it, the stratified feudalism of Iran and the caste system of India to the east, the privileged aristocracies of both Byzantine and Latin Europe to the west, the Islamic dispensation does indeed bring a message of equality. Not only does Islam not endorse such systems of social differentiation, it explicitly and resolutely rejects them. The actions and utterances of the Prophet, the honored precedents of the early rulers of Islam as preserved by tradition, are overwhelmingly against privilege by descent, by birth, by status, by wealth, or even by race, and insist that rank and honor are determined only by piety and merit in Islam. The realities of conquest and empire, however, inevitably created new elites, and in the natural course of events, these sought to perpetuate for their descendants the advantages that they had gained. From early until modern times, there has been a recurring tendency in Islamic states for aristocracies to emerge. These are differently defined and arise from varying circumstances at different times and in different places. What is significant is that the emergence of elites or castes or aristocracies happens in spite of Islam and not as part of it. Again and again through Islamic history, the establishment of privilege was seen and denounced by both severely traditional conservatives and dubiously orthodox radicals as a non-Islamic or even an anti-Islamic innovation. The egalitarianism of traditional Islam is not, however, complete. From the beginning, Islam recognized certain social inequalities, which are sanctioned and indeed sanctified by Holy Writ. But even in the three basic inequalities of master and slave, man and woman, believer and unbeliever, the situation in the classical Islamic civilization was in some respects better than elsewhere. The Muslim woman had property rights unparalleled in the modern West until comparatively recent times. Even for the slave, Islamic law recognized human rights. The term civil rights has no meaning in the context of those times and places, unknown in classical antiquity in the Orient or in the colonial and post-colonial societies of the Americas. But these three basic inequalities remained, established and unchallenged. In the course of the centuries, a whole series of radical movements of social and religious protest arose within the Islamic world, seeking to overthrow the barriers that from time to time arose between high-born and low-born, rich and poor, Arab and non-Arab, white and black, all regarded as contrary to the true spirit of Islamic brotherhood. None of these movements ever questioned the three sacrosanct distinctions establishing the subordinate status of the slave, the woman, and the unbeliever. In the Islamic states, from early until later times, the free male Muslim enjoyed a considerable measure of freedom of opportunity. The Islamic revelation, when it was first carried by the conquerors to countries previously incorporated in the ancient Middle Eastern empires, had brought immense and revolutionary social changes. Islamic doctrine was strongly opposed to hereditary privileges of all kinds, even including, in principle, the institution of monarchy. And though this pristine egalitarianism was in many ways modified and diluted, it remained strong enough to prevent the emergence of either Brahmins or aristocrats, and to preserve a society in which merit and ambition might still hope to find their reward. In later times, this egalitarianism was somewhat restricted. The abolition of the Ottoman devşirme, the levy of Christian boys to serve in the janissaries, had closed the main avenue of upward social mobility, while the formation and persistence of such ensconced privileged groups as the urban and rural notables and the ulema restricted the number of openings accessible to newcomers. In spite of this, however, it is probably true that even at the beginning of the 19th century, a poor man of humble origin had a better chance of attaining to wealth, power, and dignity in the Islamic lands than in any of the states of Christian Europe, including post-revolutionary France. There was still opportunity for those who were free, male, and Muslim, but there were severe restrictions on those who lacked any of these three essential qualifications. The slave, the woman, and the unbeliever were subject to strictly enforced legal as well as social disabilities, affecting them in almost every aspect of their daily lives. These disabilities were seen as an inherent part of the structure of Islam, buttressed by revelation, by the precept and practice of the Prophet, and by the classical and scriptural history of the Islamic community. All three, the slave, the woman, and the unbeliever, were seen as performing necessary functions, although there was occasional doubt about the third. Islamic slavery, certainly by the 19th century, was often domestic rather than economic, and slaves as well as women thus had their place in family and home life. The rules regulating their status were seen as part of the law of personal status, the inner citadel of the holy law. The position of the non-Muslim, on the other hand, was a public rather than a personal matter, and was differently perceived. The purpose of the restriction was not, as with the slave and the woman, to preserve the sanctity of the Muslim home, but to maintain the supremacy of Islam in the polity and society that the Muslims had created. Any attempt to remove or even to modify the legal subordination of these three groups would thus have challenged the free male Muslim in two sensitive areas: his personal authority in the Muslim home, his communal primacy in the Muslim state. In the course of the 19th century, for the first time in Islamic history, voices were raised in favor of all three groups of inferiors, and suggestions were made for the abrogation or at least the alleviation of their status of inferiority. These new trends were due in part to influences and pressures, the two are far from identical, from outside. They were also affected, and in an important sense made possible, by changing attitudes among the Muslims themselves. The foreign interest in reform was very different for the three categories. The European powers were unanimous in demanding the abolition of the position of legal inferiority assigned to Christians, and incidentally also to Jews in the Muslim states, and in using every means at their disposal to persuade Muslim governments to grant equality to all their subjects, meaning, of course, their free male subjects, without discrimination by religion. Even the Tsars of Russia, who in the 19th century had introduced for their Jewish subjects a levy of male children similar in its recruitment, though not in its opportunities, to the Devşirme that the Ottomans had abandoned in the 17th century, joined in the chorus. The interest in slaves was far less widespread and was in effect confined to the British, whose interventions were mainly concerned with black slaves from Africa. There is no evidence that any of the powers showed any great interest in improving the status of Muslim women. The aim of domestic reform, and in the earlier stages of foreign intervention, was not the abolition of slavery, which would have been quite unrealistic, but its alleviation, and more specifically, the restriction and ultimately the elimination of the slave trade. Islam, in contrast to both ancient Rome and the modern colonial systems, accords the slave a certain legal status and assigns obligations as well as rights to the slave owner. He is enjoined to treat his slave humanely and can be compelled by a qadi to sell or even manumit his slave if he fails in this duty. The manumission of slaves is recommended as a meritorious act. It is not, however, required, and the institution of slavery is not only recognized, but is elaborately regulated by Islamic law. Perhaps for this very reason, the position of the slave in Muslim society was incomparably better than in either classical antiquity or 19th century North and South America. Western observers at the time often comment on the relative mildness of Middle Eastern slavery. A notable example was the Swiss Henri Dunant, the founder of the Red Cross, who visited North Africa in 1860. But while the life of a slave in Muslim society was no worse, and in many ways rather better, than that of the free poor, the processes by which slaves were acquired and transported often imposed appalling hardships. It was these that drew the main attention of European opponents of the slave trade, and it was to the elimination of this traffic, particularly in Africa, that their main efforts were devoted. From a traditional Muslim point of view, to abolish slavery would hardly have been possible. To forbid what God permits is almost as great an offense as to permit what God forbids. Slavery was authorized, and its regulation formed part of the Sharia, more important, of the central core of social laws, which remained intact and effective even when other sections of the Holy Law, dealing with civil, criminal, and similar matters, were tacitly or even openly modified and replaced by modern codes. It is thus not surprising that the strongest resistance to the proposed changes came from conservative religious quarters, and particularly from the holy cities of Mecca and Medina. In their view, they were upholding an institution sanctified by scripture and law, and one, moreover, necessary for the maintenance of the traditional structure of family life. The reduction and effective abolition of the slave trade in the Ottoman Empire was in the main accomplished in the course of the 19th century. The process of emancipation seems to have begun in 1830, when a ferman was issued, ordering the emancipation of slaves of Christian origin who had kept to their religion. This was, in effect, an amnesty for Greek and other Christian subjects of the Ottoman Empire who had been reduced to slavery as a punishment for participating in the recent risings. Those who had become Muslims were excluded from this emancipation and remained the property of their owners. Those who were still Christians were set free. In earlier times, white slaves were brought from Europe, either by purchase or by capture. By the 19th century, the great majority of white slaves, however, both Christian and Muslim, came not from the suppression of rebellion, but by purchase from the Caucasian lands. Georgians and Circassians were greatly appreciated both in Persia and in the Ottoman lands, the men for battle, the women for pleasure. They arrived either overland or by sea from the Black Sea ports. Their movements and their subsequent fate were beyond the range of interest of the Western powers and were exclusively Ottoman and Persian concerns. This is also true of the Ottoman attempt to deal with this problem, undertaken without external pressure, by force of internal circumstances, and by due process of law. The Ottoman authorities were able to accomplish a substantial improvement in the condition of these slaves, amounting ultimately to the effective, though still not legal, abolition of their servile status. The restriction of the traffic in blacks, in contrast, seems to have been due very largely to British pressure. A British request in 1846 to Muhammad Shah of Persia was rejected on the grounds that Islam permitted slavery and he therefore could not forbid it. Eventually, the British and Persian governments reached a compromise agreement, but efforts by the Royal Navy to enforce this agreement in the Persian Gulf and Indian Ocean continued to cause friction. After several limited and local measures, in 1857, the British succeeded in obtaining a major Ottoman ferman prohibiting the traffic in black slaves throughout the empire, with the exception of the Hijaz. The circumstances that led to this exception throw some light on traditionalist attitudes to social equalization. The movement against slavery in the Islamic lands was due only in part to Western influence. The first Muslim ruler to emancipate the black slaves was the Bey of Tunis, who in January 1846 decreed that a deed of enfranchisement should be given to every black slave who desired it. Among the reasons for this action, he notes the uncertainty among Muslim jurists concerning the legal basis for the state of slavery into which the black races have fallen, and the need to prevent the black slaves from seeking the protection of foreign authorities. That the first of these was a genuine concern of conscientious Muslims is shown by a striking passage in the 19th century Moroccan historian Ahmad Khalid al-Nasiri, 1834 to 1897, discussing the illegal enslavement of Muslim blacks. Al-Nasiri was writing entirely within the context of traditional society, but was clearly affected by the new anti-slavery ideas current at the time. he recognizes the legality of the institution of slavery in Muslim law, but is appalled by its application. He complains in particular of a manifest and shocking calamity, widespread and established since of old in the lands of the Maghrib, the unlimited enslavement of the blacks and the importation of many droves of them every year for sale in the town and country markets of the Maghrib, where men traffic in them like beasts or worse. While conceding that heathens may lawfully be enslaved, Al-Nasiri reminds his readers that Muslims may not. By now, he argues, a majority, or at least a substantial minority, of the blacks are Muslims, and since the natural condition of man is freedom, they should be given the benefit of the doubt. The evidence of slave traders is dismissed as interested and unreliable, and the traders themselves are condemned as men without morals, virtue, or religion. In all those parts of the region that were subject to European rule or dominance, slavery was in time abolished, in practice as well as in law. It remained legal in the Ottoman Empire and in Persia until the early 20th century. It was finally abolished in Yemen and Saudi Arabia in 1962. Today, in most of the Middle East as elsewhere, chattel slavery is no longer morally and socially acceptable. Even those who demand the restoration of Quranic law usually stop short of demanding the application of those particular provisions. There are indeed some places in or near the region where slavery has been restored, but these are peripheral. The movement for the emancipation of non-Muslims began much earlier, but unlike that for the emancipation of slaves, appears initially to have evoked no support in Islamic circles. The process began at the end of the 18th century, when Bonaparte's expedition and administration in Egypt drew extensively on the services of Coptic and other local Christians. The French seem to have attached little importance to modifying the institution of slavery, and many of them indeed bought concubines for their own use, sometimes with unfortunate results. They could not, however, tolerate the continuance of the numerous restrictions and disabilities imposed by Muslim law and tradition on Christians. These were abolished, and through their connections with the French, the Christians of Egypt obtained a position considerably better than equality. This may help to explain the very sharp Muslim reaction against them. Even the contemporary Egyptian historian Al-Jabarti, in general an open-minded observer willing to recognize some of the positive aspects of French rule, comments very negatively on the emancipation and employment of Copts in what was tantamount to a termination of the Dhimma. He was particularly offended by their wearing fine clothes and bearing arms, contrary to old established usage, by their exercising authority over the affairs and even the persons of the Muslims, and generally acting in a way that, in his eyes, was a reversal of the proper order of things as established by the law of God. While Al-Jabarti shows only modified enthusiasm in welcoming the return of Ottoman authority, he rejoices particularly in the restoration of the Dhimma and of the restrictions it imposed on his Coptic compatriots. The brief French occupation of Egypt and of some of the Greek islands, and still more, the permanent Russian annexation of Transcaucasia, posed entirely new problems for both the Muslims and the Dhimmi subjects. The appearance of Armenians in the service of the advancing Russian power on the eastern frontier of Turkey, like the employment of Christian and occasionally Jewish subjects of the Ottoman Empire by the Western powers, created new tensions and produced new reasons for Muslim resentment. A similar problem, though on a smaller scale, arose in Persia, where the non-Muslim minorities consisted of Armenians, both Orthodox and Catholic, Nestorians, Zoroastrians, and Jews. They did not, however, form territorially contiguous majority populations, and therefore did not raise what became a major issue in the Ottoman lands. The Christian subjects of the Porte now found themselves involved in the pursuit of what were, in the last analysis, mutually exclusive objectives deriving from incompatible philosophies. The status of Dhimmi, or protected non-Muslim subjects of the Muslim state, was incompatible with the acceptance of the protection or patronage sometimes even the citizenship, of a foreign power. Both were incompatible with the quest for equality of rights before the law as equal Ottoman citizens. And this in turn was undermined by the parallel trend towards separation, autonomy, or independence in most of the predominantly Christian provinces of the empire. Yet despite these and other difficulties, the new idea struck root, and in the course of the 19th century, the concept of equal citizenship for Ottoman subjects of different religions gradually gained strength. It drew its main support from the continuing and growing pressure of the European powers for reform within the empire. But it also began to draw, by the mid-century, on a significant group of reformers among the Muslim Turks themselves, trying to bring their country into line with what they perceived as modern enlightenment. In Persia, the movement for enlightenment, thus interpreted, was later and slower, and encountered significant resistance. The Ottoman rescript of the Rose Bower, promulgated on November 3, 1839, took a first minor official step in this direction, dealing with such matters as the security of life, honour, and property of the subject, fiscal reform, regular and orderly recruitment into the armed services, judicial reform, and the like. The edict goes on to say that these imperial concessions are extended to all our subjects, of whatever religion or sect they may be. The edict of 1839 was, in principle, concerned with administering existing laws and enforcing existing rights, rather than creating new ones. The notion, however, of the equality of persons of all religions before the law and in the application of the law represented a radical breach with the past and posed some problems of acceptance for Muslims. The issue became more urgent in a new phase of the reform that began in 1854 and involved significant changes affecting the status of both slaves and unbelievers. To the dismay of many, the Ottoman government indicated its intention to abolish the two major forms of discrimination against non-Muslims, the jizya, or poll tax, which had universally been imposed by Muslim governments on tolerated non-Muslim subjects, and the ban on bearing arms, a restriction of almost equal universality and duration. These reforms were embodied in the new reform charter, the Imperial Rescript, issued on February 18, 1856, in which the Sultan laid down, in much more explicit terms than previously, the full equality of all Ottomans irrespective of religion, while at the same time reaffirming all the privileges and immunities accorded in former times by my ancestors to all the Christian communities and other non-Muslim religions established in my empire. It took some time to perceive the inherent contradiction between these two. The resolution of that contradiction came only with the dissolution of the empire. These two major reforms, the equalization of non-Muslims and the ban on the traffic in black slaves, came at approximately the same time. By early 1855, the impact of these changes was already affecting the Hijaz, where there was special concern about the measures against slavery. The reduction in the supply of white slaves from the Caucasus, resulting from the Russian conquest, had already caused alarm. This was heightened by the imposition of restrictions on the importation of black slaves from Africa. On April 1, 1855, a group of prominent merchants in Jeddah addressed a letter to the leading members of the Ulema, as well as to the Sharif of Mecca, expressing their concern. They referred, with disapproval, to the steps that already had been taken, and quoted a rumor that the impending reforms would include a general ban on the slave trade, together with other pernicious and Christian-inspired changes, such as the emancipation of women, permission for unbelievers to live in Arabia, and the toleration of mixed marriages. The ban, along with the whole program of reform of which it was a part, was condemned by the writers of the letter as an offense against holy law, the more so since all the black slaves imported from Africa embraced the Muslim religion. The letter caused some excitement. The Sharif consulted the chief of the Ulema of Mecca, Sheikh Jamal, and a few months later, when the governor of the Hijaz sent an order to the district governor of Mecca prohibiting the trade in slaves, Sheikh Jamal issued a fatwa denouncing the ban and some other projected or rumored reforms. The ban on slaves is contrary to the holy Sharia. Furthermore, the abandonment of the noble call to prayer in favor of firing a gun, permitting women to walk unveiled, placing divorce in the hands of women and such like, are contrary to the pure holy law. With such proposals, the Turks have become infidels. Their blood is forfeit, and it is lawful to make their children slaves. The fatwa produced the desired effect. A holy war was proclaimed against the Ottomans, and the revolt began. It did not succeed, and by June of the following year it had been completely crushed. The Sultan's government had, however, noted the warning, and took steps to forestall a secession of the slave-owning Ottoman South. A letter from the chief mufti of Istanbul, Arif Effendi, to the Qadi Mufti, Ulema, Sharifs, Imams, and Preachers of Mecca, answered the slanderous rumors. It has come to our hearing, and has been confirmed to us, that certain impudent persons, lustful for the goods of this world, have fabricated strange lies, and invented repulsive vanities, to the effect that the lofty Ottoman state was perpetrating, Almighty God preserve us, such things as the prohibition of the selling of male and female slaves, the prohibition of the call to prayer from minarets, the prohibition of the veiling of women and the concealment of their private parts, the putting of the right to divorce into the hands of women, the seeking of the aid of people who are not of our religion, and the taking of enemies as intimates and friends, all of which is nothing but libelous lies. In the ban on the trade in black slaves promulgated in 1857, the province of the Hijaz was exempted. The equalization of the non-Muslims, like the restriction of the slave trade, struck at powerful vested interests, not all of them on the Muslim side. For the Muslims, it meant the loss of the supremacy that they had long regarded as their right. But for Christians too, or at least for the Christian leadership, it involved the loss of entrenched and recognized privileges. It also involved equalization downward, as well as upward, a change not entirely to the taste of some who regarded themselves as standing on the higher rungs of the ladder. A contemporary Ottoman source remarks, "In accordance with this ferman, Muslim and non-Muslim subjects were to be made equal in all rights. This had a very adverse effect on the Muslims. Previously, one of the 4 points adopted as basis for peace agreements, musalaha, had been that certain privileges were accorded to Christians, on condition that these did not infringe the sovereign authority of the government. Now the question of the specific privileges lost its significance. In the whole range of government, the non-Muslims were forthwith to be deemed the equals of the Muslims. Many Muslims began to grumble. Today we have lost our sacred national, mili, rights, won by the blood of our fathers and forefathers. At a time when the Islamic millet is the ruling millet, it has been deprived of this sacred right. This is a day of weeping and mourning for the people of Islam. As for the non-Muslims, this day, when they left the status of Raya and gained equality with the ruling millet, was a day of rejoicing. But the patriarchs and other religious chiefs were displeased, because their appointments were incorporated in the Ferman. Another point was that whereas in former times in the Ottoman state the communities were ranked, with the Muslim first, then the Greeks, then the Armenians, then the Jews, now all of them were put on the same level. Some Greeks objected to this, saying, "The government has put us together with the Jews. We were content with the supremacy of Islam." It is significant, and in no way surprising, that the conservatives in the Hijaz, in their sharp reaction against the reforms of the mid-century, lumped actions in favor of the three groups, slaves, women, and unbelievers, together. It is also noteworthy that they are strikingly specific in naming the aspects of female emancipation to which they objected: the right to move around freely, the right to go unveiled, the right to initiate divorce proceedings. No doubt these were the changes mentioned in the rumors reaching their ears. On the slave and the unbeliever, their information was broadly correct, and the changes were as they feared, though not to the extent of admitting non-Muslims to Arabia, or permitting mixed marriages between Muslim women and non-Muslim men. Marriages between Muslim men and non-Muslim women were, of course, permitted by the Sharia, and were not uncommon. On women's rights, however, they seem to have been entirely mistaken. The powers of Europe, so solicitous on behalf of Christians and slaves, remained unmoved by the condition of the female population of the empire, though it was no doubt known to them, at least in its more picturesque aspects, from an extensive and sometimes prurient literature. The position of women does not seem to figure among the concerns of Western critics of Ottoman and other Muslim institutions. Ottoman liberals and reformers show slightly more concern, but this in the main found literary rather than political or legislative expression. A long time was to pass before the women of the empire raised their own voices. In Persia, neither foreign critics nor Muslim liberals and reformers showed much interest in women's rights. But Persian women themselves began the fight for emancipation. A notable figure was Qurrat al-Ayn, 1814 to 1852, the eldest daughter of an eminent Shiite Muslim theologian. She appears to have received a good Islamic education, but became an active follower of the Bab, the famous Islamic reformer who created what was virtually a new religion in 19th century Persia. Among other offenses, she preached without a veil and denounced polygamy. She was martyred, along with at least 27 other Babis, and was put to death by torture. A very different figure was the Princess Taj es-Sultana, the daughter of the Nasir ed-Din Shah. Educated in the royal household in French, as well as in Persian literature, she became keenly aware of the difference in status between the women of the West and the women of Persia. In her writings, principally memoirs and some poems, she denounced the bondage and misery to which her female compatriots were subjected. These seeds fell on fertile soil, and in the events that led to the constitutional revolution in Persia, 1906, to 1911, women are said to have played an important part. In the words of a contemporary American observer, "It is not too much to say that without the powerful moral force of the so-called chattels of the Oriental lords of creation, the ill-starred and short-lived revolutionary movement, however well conducted by the Persian men, would have early paled into a mere disorganized protest. The women did much to keep the spirit of liberty alive. Having themselves suffered from a double form of oppression, political and social, they were the more eager to foment the great nationalist movement for the adoption of constitutional forms of government and the inculcation of Western political, social, commercial, and ethical codes. Equally strange is the fact that this yearning by the people received the support of large numbers of the Islamic priests, a class which stood to lose much of its traditional influence and privilege by the contemplated changes. In this last respect, the situation has since changed radically." Chapter 5. Secularism and the Civil Society. Secularism, in the modern political meaning, the idea that religion and political authority, church and state, are different and can or should be separated, is, in a profound sense, Christian. Its origins may be traced in the teachings of Christ, confirmed by the experience of the first Christians. Its later development was shaped and, in a sense, imposed by the subsequent history of Christendom. The persecutions endured by the early church made it clear that a separation between the two was possible. The persecutions inflicted by later churches persuaded many Christians that such a separation was necessary. The older religions of mankind were all related to, were, in a sense, a part of, authority, whether of the tribe, the city, or the king. The cult provided a visible symbol of group identity and loyalty. The faith provided sanction for the ruler and his laws. Something of this pre-Christian function of religion survives, or reappears, in Christendom, where from time to time priests exercised temporal power, and kings claimed divine right even over the church. But these were aberrations from Christian norms, seen and reciprocally denounced as such by royal and clerical spokesmen. The authoritative Christian text on these matters is the famous passage in Matthew 22:21, in which Christ is quoted as saying, "Render therefore unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's." Commentators have differed as to the precise meaning and intention of this phrase, but for most of Christian history, it has been understood as authorizing the separate coexistence of two authorities, the one charged with matters of religion, the other with what we would nowadays call politics. In this, the practice of Christianity was in marked contrast with both its precursors and its competitors. In imperial Rome, Caesar was God, reasserting a doctrine that goes back to the god-kings of remote antiquity. Among the Jews, for whose beliefs Josephus coined the term theocracy, God was Caesar. For the Muslims, too, God was the supreme sovereign, and the caliph was his vice-regent, his shadow on earth. Only in Christendom did God and Caesar coexist in the state, albeit with considerable development, variety, and sometimes conflict in the relations between them. The early Christian experience of defying or avoiding authority was not without precedents. The Jews had offered numerous examples of a religion surviving the persecution of a hostile sovereignty, of perseverance as sojourners in the alien land of Egypt, of prophetic protest against their own erring kings, and, in the struggle of the Maccabees, of resistance to foreign and pagan conquest and domination. In Persia, Zoroaster initiated a religious and moral change, which in time took over the state. Still further away, in India, the mission of the Buddha and the subsequent work of his missionaries first brought the idea of a universal religion with a message to all mankind. Even pagan Rome offers examples of religiously inspired or religiously expressed opposition to the Roman state, both from independent peoples resisting Roman conquest and from provincial subjects resisting Roman rule. None of this is remotely comparable